That's Segundo here. I don't know who this Rupert Thompson guy is, but our young roving correspondent seems quite taken by him. He's very excited. Indeed, the two men talked for a very long time. This is the first of a two-part interview. Perhaps it's because Mr. Thompson is British. I remember many years ago waking up naked in the motel room, not knowing how I got there. I felt around the bed with my hands and stumbled upon a very thick handlebar mustache, which belonged to another man. I screamed, and so did this man, who was equally as puzzled as me. But the difference between me and this man was that he screamed with a British accent. Since that regrettable incident, I've tried to be more careful over the years, and have explicitly asked every person I've met whether or not they are British. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm starting to get a little bit creeped out, and I need to take a cold shower.
Okay, so I'm here with Rupert Thompson, who is the author of the Book of Revelation, Divided Kingdom, and most recently, Death of a Murderer. Rupert, how are you doing?
Pretty good, thank you.
Anyway, we're going to have sort of a two-part sort of conversation because we're trying to work this around your lunch, so this will be the pre-lunch part.
Right.
So I guess we'll start off...
The stomach rumbler.
Yeah, we'll start off with a little the simpler questions, and once you've eaten, we'll get to the sort of, you know, more complex...
When I'm drowsy.
Exactly. Well, I wanted to actually ask you about, you know, Billy Tyler in this. You present him as one of society's dustmen, as he actually
exactly.
is described. And yet you won't actually name, you don't actually name the murderer, who is based very much on Myra Hindley. I guess was class, and particularly this overlooked notion of people who are unnamed kind of serving and protecting or doing the dusting up of the streets. Was this a factor from the get-go? Or?
No. Well, it was from the get-go, but it was for a different reason. And funnily enough, I'm beginning to get this reputation for writing about characters who don't have names, because the Book of Revelation, the dancer, was never named.
That's true.
That was for a different reason. This one, I started off in the first draft using Myra Hindley's name, and something odd happened, because this is a kind of fiction set in fact. I mean, I always think of it like a ring. You know, you have this kind of setting, which is the fact, and that has to feel really solid and authentic, and then you drop the fiction in like a, well, hopefully like a beautiful stone.
Yeah.
But the... using the word Hindley kind of capsized the whole fiction. It was odd. As a fact, as a word, actually, it seemed to weigh too much. It seemed to weigh more than other words. And I simply took it out. And then I found myself writing this scene early on in the novel where Billy Tyler's wife, who's trying to persuade him not to go to work that day, not to have to look after this murderer's body, you know, she doesn't mention the name either, because she doesn't want that woman in the house, kind of thing, you know. And I suddenly thought, well, that's interesting. Kind of, you don't want that woman in the novel either.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because Billy Tyler and Myra Hindley have four syllables each in their name, so it's a matter
not
of
not intentional. No,
yeah.
Just.
But yet,
well, someone once started an interview by saying, your book begins in water and ends in fire.
Hmm.
That's and there true. Was a long silence after that, because first of all, I hadn't realized that, and secondly, it didn't really mean anything.
And yet there's also actually a bridge. Actually, I wanted to ask you about Ambrose Bierce's An Occurrence in Owl Creek Bridge. It seemed to me that since that story takes place in flashbacks, and Billy Tyler is something...
I haven't read that story.
You haven't?
No.
Because there's even a bridge by the Tyler homes. I was like reading this going, okay, so he has more of a flashback structure than the norm, and I was wondering if Bierce... But apparently, I guess...
No.
Sense.
I mean, this was very new. This felt like very new territory for me, because I seem to have this reputation for writing really direct, quite fast books, put it like this, people seem to read them quite fast, and one of my jobs, one of the missions I've set for myself over the long term, you know, is to slow the reader down. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And because I sort of always have felt like they've read my books too fast, and while you have a sense of that there's depth there, there's kind of archaeology, there's stuff, there are lots of things built in that people are kind of hopefully getting in one form or another. I just like them to go a little more slowly. And I tried in the Book of Revelation by breaking up I broke it into lots of small sections. And I used this kind of particular symbol, which actually was taken from dance notation, you know. So it would be a thing that people didn't understand, but actually it meant... separate. It meant two people separating. So it was supposed to kind of slow them down. But they
but
just
it,
jumped
but
from
just,
one section to
I
the
know,
next and
I know.
And they read it as fast, if not faster, than any other book.
That's interesting.
So this one, I mean, I didn't perversely set out to write a book with a difficult structure, but this is probably the most, this was probably the most difficult book to assemble, you know, of anything I've done so far. So as you say, you know, it's almost 100% flashback novel.
Yeah.
And yet the way it flashes back is like there are probably sort of 6-7 stories that he's flashing back to, the policeman, in his life, his various obsessions and his wrongdoings. But he flashes back chronologically, if you can say that. I mean, not in a chronological form. So you may take one of those stories and he may remember the middle, and then he may later remember the beginning, and then later still he may remember the end, you know. And all the stories are remembered in different orders, and so they form this kind of jigsaw, hopefully, you know, that creates the right kind of resonance.
That's interesting you mentioned that you wanted to slow the reader down, because I was going to ask you about, you know, you're known in all of your books, there are these very just absolutely pitch-perfect similes in the sense that, you know, like the Five Gates of Hell, you have the thing that I always remember where you have the flame going across the building and you compare it to a sheep being over a bed, and you have this sort of simile approach, like a so-and-so, and it's all throughout Five Gates of Hell, it's all throughout all your book.
You used to have a lot of.
But it's not so much in Death of a Murderer, and I was wondering...
No. I was very aware of that. That was the other thing. I mean, it's weird. Style is nearly always dictated by content, you know, and that's particularly true of this one, because there's somehow if you're writing about a person who is an icon of evil in your own country and is taboo.
It was at this point that the two gentlemen's lunch was interrupted by a manager who wanted to know what microphones were doing on the table and then gave them food. So pardon this particular interlude, the interview shall continue after the two men have ingested their sandwiches.
Oh, you mean if I got something in my mouth?
You took a bite out of that fry and had this great crispy sound. I was just like...
That would have been good.
And if I amped that up, it would just sound really marvelous. But anyway, okay.
It's like when people smoke on really good... You know, get that inhale sound of the crackling of the... It's a really good sound. Absolutely. I forget which film had that in it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, David Lynch did that quite a lot, too, in Wild at Heart.
It must have.
Yeah, because there was either the whole...
Close-ups on cigarettes and just that,
But anyway, I do remember what we were talking about, and that was, we were talking about the similes and why you did not have so many of them in Death of a Murderer. So what, maybe you can also talk about how these sorts of, how they came to be, because I know you worked as a copywriter. I was wondering if trying to find that particular metaphor that was so compelling that everyone would recognize, is this what kind of, do you work or labor on these?
No, I don't labor on them. They come really, they're like second nature, these images, and I... You know, it's funny because you read people like Flaubert, and Flaubert says, you know, I just can't help thinking of these things that are like other things, and I wish I didn't do it, you know, and I shouldn't do it really. I shouldn't do it as much as I do. And I've always felt that a bit. The early books, Dreams of Leaving, The Five Gates of Hell, are kind of, you know, it's like fireworks are going off on the page all the time, and with language and with imagery. And I'm kind of, I think early on in a career of a writer, you're just... You are really excited about being on the page anyway, so you're going to kind of put more in there than you... You know, 10 years go by, you're a little more used to being on the page. And with this particular book, I mean, Death of a Murderer, it just didn't invite the fireworks, you know? I thought this kind of book is going to draw all its power from emotion. That's what I wanted it to do. I didn't want the language to be special at all. In fact, I removed as much of the imagery as I could, because as I say, it kind of happens naturally. And the images that are left there now are really kind of discrete ones. Like, I've got one when he goes up onto the moor where the children's bodies were buried, east of Manchester, and it's late 1999 and it's snowing, and he stands by his car, and it's something like he hears the silence is like the silence you get when you're on the phone and there's someone on the other end not talking.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of image I'm still interested in, because it blends with the prose really seamlessly. You know, it's not like holding up its hand and saying, hello, I'm an image, which is probably what I used to do a bit sometimes. So, and this particular subject matter, because these murders made such an impression on the country, sort of, they bit deep into the psyche of the nation somehow, and they remained there. And I think if you were sort of going into if you're going into that territory, you walk a little bit lightly and you walk a little bit carefully. And to somehow use excessive language seems so totally wrong. You know, it seemed almost like an insult to the families of the victims who were still alive. in a peculiar way, if you see what I mean. I mean, it just, it seemed odd to be using, it seemed like, here's the perfect chance for me to do the opposite of what I normally do. You know, let's strip language right down to its essentials. Let's use really plain, simple sentences and cut out as much as possible. And, you know, right up to the last minute, I mean, I took a whole page out of the first 19 pages in the very last draft I did, because it was, on the one hand, it was kind of slowing him down. He needed to get to the mortuary quicker. But also because it was a rather beautiful kind of extended image.
Yeah.
It was him driving to the hospital, and he's driving along this dual carriageway. You don't call them that. Like you've got two lanes going one way and two lanes going the other. That kind of semi-main road. And he was driving along, and he sees a car up. It's nighttime, and he sees a car up ahead of him, and it looks like a bridal veil is kind of blowing behind the person who's driving. And he thinks, a bride? There's no one else in the car. And he thinks, that's very strange to see a bride all alone in a car at night. You know, is she fleeing the wedding? Is she upset? Is she disturbed? You know, what's the story? So he pulls alongside, and then it's only when he looks in, as he's parallel to the other car, that he sees that it's actually a middle-aged man, and he must have just picked his car up from the garage, because the plastic from the mechanic's put plastic covers over the seats, and the plastic is kind of flapping behind his head. So not a bride at all.
I thought.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's actually quite a lot of plastic and metal in this particular book, and because for example, you have the one active, you know, behavior that Billy does is basically putting his fist against the metal bin. Near the end,
right? Yes,
and you know, you have all this description of vending machines and the like, and I wanted to ask you about, you know, you're talking about wanting to kind of stay sort of, I guess, as lean as you could out of respect for the victims.
Less is more.
But you're not too, you know, you're not, at least you're deviant about it.
Yeah.
But still, you have this embedded nature of the world, of the descriptions of the world. And I wanted to actually ask you about how the plastic and metal, did this kind of just come... This goes to a sort of a question about the struggle of the internal struggle of Billy versus whether the world actually keeps him down into this kind of rudderless existence.
Right. Oh, well, I mean, it was odd because all that plastic and metal came out of the research. I mean, as I kind of suggested early on, there was a lot of it, because this is a book that sits in fact, and the fact had to feel very authentic, because, you know, this body really was guarded by real policemen. I didn't go to any policeman who'd guarded the body, but I spent quite a lot of time in the hospital.
Really?
In the hospital where it happened, and particularly I had to get into the mortuary where the actual body was kept, and this was very difficult to do. I mean, I had to arm myself with letters from people saying that I was a man of high moral standing and a pillar of the community.
Really?
all that
was that a tough
well
sell?
I.e. that I wasn't a journalist.
Okay, yeah, exactly.
I mean, because that's what they're worried about with that story. They're yeah. worried about journalists still poking around even after she's dead, and also, you know, with me approaching the police and approaching the National Health Service, so the people who run the hospitals in the UK, they're both really tricky organisations. They're both rather wary of people coming to them, people like me especially. But I managed to get most of what I wanted, and I did get into the mortuary at 1 a.m. I found a woman who had to sort of sidestep a few people who were being awkward, and I finally found someone who got me in there, and I filmed in the mortuary, which I never thought I'd be able to do. And had I not been able to do that, this kind of plastic and metal stuff, the dents, the marks, the blemishes on the surface of the real world, which seemed really important for this book. I wanted all the damage, you know, no matter how insignificant it might seem, to be there. So you've got, you know, because I filmed inside the mortuary, I've got on camera the bottom of the inside of the mortuary door, and like 3 feet above the ground, there are all these little indentations, mm-hmm. little round indentations, and
which made the right of the book. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I found out what the, you know, had to ask what they were, because I didn't know. And of course, it's people wheeling the dead bodies around on trolleys or gurneys or whatever they are, and I looked at them and I lined one of them up with the door, and sure enough, you know, they don't push open the door by hand. They use the trolley to bash the door open, and you know, it's something to do with that kind of job. Makes you a little
jumpy, I guess.
Well, jumpy, and like a little bit almost deliberately callous. You have to adopt an air of callousness, otherwise it's going to get to you. You know, so you've got to be deliberately insensitive and to survive, I think, in work like that. But you know, had I not got into the mortuary and had I not filmed, I wouldn't have imagined those dents. And a lot of the plastic and metal you're talking about came about in a similar way. I mean, really late on, I realized that, you know, he had a newspaper with a picture of, the policeman had a newspaper with a picture of Mara Hindley on the front, and he has it in the back of the car because he bought the papers over the weekend when she died, and he just doesn't feel comfortable with any of those papers in the car anymore, so he has to get rid of them. This is quite near the end of the book, and
yes.
He remembers there being what we call a wheelie bin. I don't know what you call them, but like these garbage bins with wheels on that get picked up. They're often in the country and lay-bys and car parks,
yeah.
I making notes towards the end of the manuscript when I was just kind of checking things and final bits of research. This was one of them. I had to go and find the bin, you know.
Yeah.
So that was on my list of things. I went to the town. I went to the place where he was at that moment in the novel, and then there was a bin in the perfect place. And a bin of the perfect, even better bin than I could have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just was the perfect bin to have found. And because it had a lid, so he could sort of slam. I hadn't imagined a bin with a lid for some reason. It had this lid that he could close on the whole matter, you know.
Yes.
And just, it's funny how James Joyce says somewhere that chance provides me with what I need. And I often feel like that. You know, when you're writing a novel, you just, somehow the research takes you to places, and then you're never disappointed. You always find exactly what you need.
Going back to this idea of you sort of, I guess, avoiding these similes that you had in your early work for this book, I wanted to again comment upon the embedding within this book. Like, for example, there's Arthurian namesakes throughout. There's the dog of King Arthur's dog, Cabal. There's, of course, Raymond Percival, who is anything...
But it
seems as if he is almost like operating in the reverse against the nature of Percival, because he's such a, you know, he's terrible. I mean, he's far from honorable, you know. And also, of course, Newman, who is not exactly what I would call a Newman. He's more of an old world figure. There are many old world figures.
What's Arthurian about Newman, then?
No, this is not Arthurian.
Oh,
I'm so sorry.
Right.
I meant to say that Newman knew men.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
He's not exactly what I would call a Newman. If anything, he's an old world figure. So there's a lot of these inversions of character names throughout
this
book.
That's interesting. You see, now some of that I'm aware of, but some of it I'm not.
Mm.
I mean, Percival, why did I choose that surname? I've no idea how I came up with that now, but that was there right from the very beginning. And it just seemed right. It's kind of like a slightly old-fashioned British surname,
yeah.
You know, and I obviously I was going against type there as well, you know, because he's from a completely different generation. This guy Raymond. So some of these inversions are going to be intuitive, you know. I think. I mean, I'm just such a.
But the fact that all of them are inverted from, like, you know, I guess literary references. I mean, you know, obviously there's some perhaps attention here, but I mean, I guess. What do you do to kind of get your sort of brain tinkered into this almost subconscious inversion of what has gone before? Because I know you keep a small library of books, and that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, sir. No, it's not going to the books at all. It's in fact, it's probably the reverse. It's probably not looking at the books, and probably these kind of things tend to happen in the first draft. I mean, I this is certainly the case with this book, and it was also the case with the Book of Revelation, that I wrote the first draft very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Book of Revelation was 29 days. This was 41.
Really?
So that's from beginning to end.
Wow.
And that is...
These are the mammoth sort of texts you produced that you cut down? Or was
no.
This was
is,
that just the case with Divided Kingdom?
Divided Kingdom happened a different way.
Yeah, okay, got it.
These two just were... It was as if they were just really ready, waiting to come out. And so they came very fast, and that's not to say that they're by no means perfectly written, these first drafts. They're going to be thin in some places, thick in others. They're going to be, but the weird thing about both of them is they sank very quickly to a deep place and gathered lots of stuff up and brought it with them. You know, it's almost like. In fact, I often think of it as horizontal rather than vertical. I mean, I think of it as as if you're skimming over a piece of water and you're going really fast and really close to the surface, and somehow that tension that you create in that gap between you and the water, you're picking stuff up as you go.
Yeah.
That's sort of what a first draft feels like to me, and I reach the end without having... reach the end without really having realized what I've done, and then I leave a gap and go back and look at it. But a lot of the decisions that you're talking about are not conscious. I discover them intuitively, and then I approve them later on. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's always that moment where your hat slightly changes, you know, and you go from being this intuitive madman who's having nightmares every night to the kind of ruthless critic of your own work, you know, and really examining the craft of what you've done. You know, in those later stages, you will examine all those details. But you know, with something like a name, a character's name, if I've had it since the beginning, it's going to seem so second nature to me by the time I've done 10, 11 drafts that I can't really imagine that character being called anything else. Mm. So, you know, far from... I suppose I'm not agreeing with you. I suppose what I'm saying is that Percival, you know, kind of lost all references and all resonance, except for the fact that it was his surname and it was only his, you know, yeah. It could only be his name. So it's a curious process, and I sometimes think that you would, that as a novelist, you know, I sometimes wonder how many decisions there are that you make in the writing of a novel. I mean, I guess it probably goes into the millions.
Yeah.
But then I think about all the decisions you don't make, where you just simply trust what your intuition has given you, you know, because in the case of Newman, for instance, you just mentioned Peter Newman. I didn't think twice about that name. Newman's a fairly ordinary name, and I wanted just an ordinary, fairly solid... And in fact, Susie, I chose that name because Billy Tyler marries a girl called Susie Newman, and I sort of wanted her to have quite a sexy-sounding name, a name that tripped off the tongue.
Yeah.
And then I like the fact that she becomes Sue Tyler, which is more, you know, she becomes dull. As a result, yeah, of having married.
I looked at him as a sort of, I guess, old world figure, because there's the whole George McGarry character as well, who, yeah, is surrounded by all these ships and these trophies, and how a character name's choice often, you know, somehow, you know, reflects a larger motif. I guess, you know, what is the sort of conscious and subconscious nature, or do you just essentially just put your blinders on and just try to get the thing right intuitively when you actually write?
I do. I sink as deep as I can, and I try not to look sideways at all, you know. I go forwards, and it's a curious thing. I mean, I'm trying to think of an example in this book, in Death of a Murderer, where I really changed something like that. I can't think of one at the moment. Well, you know, you examine something, you think, does this fit with the motif of the whole thing? There's this artist, Louise Bourgeois, and she has this great quote, which I'm not going to remember, but it's something about, I trust the unconscious is my friend. You know, I never know what I'm doing until I finish, and then I look back and I think, so that's what it was. You know, and somehow the unconscious is really good at motifs. It sort of does the work for you, you know.
Well, if you look at your work as a sort of collection of dreams, essentially,
I know.
Have nightmares about them, it makes utter sense, actually, because we all have dreams and they all fit within these sorts of strange kinds of constructs that we can't quite identify, but actually have some sort of logical, conscious taxonomy.
Yeah, it becomes dangerous when you've got a body of work,
yeah,
because once you've got 7 or 8 novels, as I have, it's really dangerous, I think, to start looking back and thinking about, because of course this is what the critics do. They,
yeah,
start looking back and saying, so this is the kind of, these are the themes you're dealing with, this is what you're dealing with. And actually, I kind of don't want to know that, because I'm still working towards some perfect expression of whatever it is. And, you know, I don't feel I'm there.
Is this why you hop around in genre quite a lot, or just?
I don't deliberately do that either. I simply think I jackdaw-like, I use whatever I need to use,
yeah,
for whatever book it is. I don't think I sit very comfortably in any genre. I mean, and sometimes publishers, out of some sense of exasperation, will try and, you know, put you in the thriller section or the crime section. And I don't think any of my books sit particularly happily in those places. Because if you're a reader and you're buying a thriller, then my books are going to kind of do something different to what you're used to.
Yeah.
And the same with crime novels, and the same with pretty much any kind of fantasy, you know, any of those genres. And a lot of my books probably mix up 2 or 3 or 4 of those in the one book.
I guess I'm wondering, though, because, like, there's a lot in this particular book that is just on the surface not entirely expressed. You write this interesting line of reader intention. Like, for example, I read this thinking that Billy was in some sense something of a repressed homosexual, because there are, you know, he has the scenario of Percival where Raymond tells him, you know, that we're going to do what the Roman emperors did. You have Billy.
That's quite subtle, though, isn't it?
Well, you also have Billy attracted to Venetia's boyish hips. There's the moment in which he takes off Trevor's clothes and notes that his legs were smooth and white and utterly without hair. And so I'm reading something like this, and I'm wondering, God, this happens so frequently, and it's not entirely expressed. Is Thompson really fucking with me, or is he just really,
he's really aware of this?
You know,
he's only partly aware of that. I mean, I hadn't really thought about the hairless legs as being a kind of homoerotic moment somehow. I was just thinking of that
as... Or perhaps confusion of gender, I don't know.
Some men do have those strange white hairless legs, don't they?
Yeah, that's true.
And Billy is used to kind of... I mean, Billy's an observer. I guess police, you know, the police do... They have this kind of very observant side. They notice things that never ceases to amaze me how many people fail to notice things.
That's true.
You know, I mean, of the ordinary people, so-called ordinary people. But policemen don't fall into that bracket. They tend to notice things, and they tend to observe quite carefully. So I didn't see that. Obviously, the Raymond Percival, that whole story has that homoerotic... I mean, it has that quality to it, but it's... I actually didn't even see that as a kind of sexual... I didn't see that as to do with gender. I simply saw that as a kind of obsession, you know, that Billy has an obsession with this boy who's roughly the same age because he's glamorous and because he's dangerous and because, you know, maybe at that age we want to be like that. He almost wants to be that person rather than to have sex with that person. So,
but he allows himself to be victimized in a way that is just...
But just in order to be close to the guy. I mean, just because he can't help but spend time with him. But I don't think that he's really sure whether he wants to take anything further. And certainly you have the sense that he's not going to initiate anything, you know, that because Raymond initiates everything.
Sure.
So you kind of wonder what would happen if Raymond had said something along those lines, you know, like if he'd pushed it a bit further. Well, but then you suspect Raymond's not in it for that. Raymond's in it for something else. I mean, maybe Raymond's in it to kill Billy. Because kill Billy. I'm going to drop as many film titles into this interview.
Feel free.
But someone said something really interesting to me about that scene by the lake.
Yeah.
Because there's a scene where they're in Italy, they're traveling together, and Raymond takes Billy out onto a kind of pedalo thing into the middle of the lake and encourages him to swim and then pedals away.
Yeah.
And Billy can't swim very well. And it's a moment where he appears to be drowning. And in the end, Raymond comes back and lets him get back in the boat. And Billy's going, "You bastard, what did you do that for? You could have killed me." And Raymond says, "Yeah, well, did you see that bar back there? Maybe we should go and have a drink." And someone said he only went pedaled back and got Billy back into the boat because maybe there was someone in that bar who saw what he was doing. And that hadn't occurred to me, actually, at all. But that's rather nice.
Yeah.
That maybe he was going to kill Billy and then... wasn't prepared to risk it because there could have been a bystander. There could have been a witness.
Well, it's very... Also, the thing is he has a tendency to, you know, like he offers, you know, he basically says food is dangerous.
Yeah.
He has a tendency to
Some funny moments.
He has a tendency to foreshadow, I'm going to really do something terrible to you, but let me kind of give you a hint.
Yeah.
Sort of quality. I'm wondering how was this a kind of, I guess, more of a... Did you feel that this kind of dark streak of humor was sort of necessary to balance some of the heavier stuff in this book?
Or? Yeah, it crept in of its own accord, actually. I didn't deliberately inject it, but there was something... It's a kind of pitiful quality, actually, that Billy has in those sections of the story, because he's such a kind of... I mean, and Mara Hindley, when she talks to him later on, you know, she says, "You behaved like a bloody girl." And there is something kind of girl in the sense of being... so beholden, so dependent, you know, so kind of a relationship of such dependency. And I suppose that's you know, I use Billy really all the way through the book as a kind of prism. You know, I always thought through the prism of this so-called ordinary man, you can then look indirectly at the so-called monster, you know. And so I'm using kind of that obsession with Raymond to sort of as a gloss on the relationship that Mara Hindley had with her boyfriend, where she equally became obsessed with this man across the room, completely fell under his spell, and would do anything that he asked.
Yeah. Well, there's also a little interesting motif, like you have the lyrics, you know, you don't explicitly allude to the song, but "And Your Brother Could Sing" by the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's that particular moment, and Billy can't even recognize the title of the song. And this struck me as, again, another sort of interesting moment, because here he is, like, almost unable. I mean, he can recognize the cues. He can recognize the cues of sort of being henpecked or exploited by women, but he can't actually, you know, pinpoint the actual precise characteristics that cause him to be sort of thrown into these sorts of things. So, "And Your Bird Could Sing" is almost like this perfect sort of choice, because it completely sums up this thing, and yet it's not explicitly about that. And it's sort of, I guess, going back to what we were sort of talking about earlier about, like, this notion of the sort of the subconscious can be trusted for all of these deeper sort of meanings.
This book has, but this, I mean, I did do a lot of building in as well with this book, because I realized it was one of those books where I almost wanted everything. I wanted all kinds of resonance, not just I wanted a lot of backwards resonance. That's what I think of it as, where, you know, you plant a certain number of things, and then you reach a scene and suddenly it casts. Almost the reader is thrown back through the book as well, at the same time as they're moving forwards.
Yeah.
So I like to create that kind of tension where resonances are going in all directions. You know, and that was what was so complicated about putting it together, because it was a mind scrambler, actually. I'd have to, in the office I had with no windows where most of this was written, I had a blackboard. I think it must have been a schoolroom of some kind once. And I had to draw. There was chalk, you know. So I started being William Faulkner. You know, William Faulkner used to write on the walls of his room, and so I started having to make maps, make lists of scenes, and work out the order that they should come in order to play off each other in the right kind of way. Cool. And that took a long, long time to work out, because then, of course, each time you moved a scene, you'd have to rewrite the end of it and the beginning of it, and it would start working in a different way. Yeah.
Had you done this for any other novels of yours?
No.
It's interesting because
It's like being Michael Ondaatje.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, the whole thing is interesting to me because I'm observing all these things that are embedded within the text. Like, it's probably, if we were to compare any of your books to being closest to Faulkner, it would probably be this one, because there's so much embedded into it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That you have to sort of detect, and yet here. Well, I'm sorry. Go for it. You were talking about all of these various scenes on the blackboard, and.
Well, no, it just. It was. I wasn't really going to say anything else about it. I don't think, was I?
Okay. Well, actually, I wanted to talk about the sort of the moral quality in this book. The only real decent figure in this book, the person who actually is out there saying, "Are you okay?" is Phil Shaw, who is Billy's sergeant. And yet, you imbue him with this terrible quality because he's gone through a divorce. So it's almost as if, you know, one cannot necessarily help anybody in this universe without having some really terrible sort of personal cost, and I'm wondering if he is sort of there to kind of inject, well, if Billy actually decides to actually, you know, take a stand or be active in his life, he'll either become some sort of old world patriarchal figure along the lines of Newman, or he'll suffer a divorce like Phil Shaw. I mean, is this...
Oh, you don't think that there's a kind of third way, that you don't think that he can kind of carry on being married and sort of take a bit more responsibility, not quite go as far as Newman, but
yeah.
I don't know, I sort of held out a bit of hope for him towards the end. I mean, I know what you're saying. I sort of think this probably holds true for almost everything I've written, that everyone, all my characters seem to be deficient or defective in some way. Yeah. I mean, I've said this before, so maybe I shouldn't say it again, but But the example is Django Reinhardt. You know, I came across this a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And that jazz musician, the way that his hands were deformed by an accident in the caravan, and the way that he had large hands anyway, it was kind of a physical deformity, an accident that had happened that allowed him to play this extraordinary music, you know. And when I read about him a couple of years ago, I read this article, I think it was in the New Yorker. I thought, that's so strange, because that's exactly like... That's exactly like all my protagonists are like that.
Yeah.
They've all suffered some kind of trauma, or they've gone through something that's, you know, not changed them physically. It's usually psychically or mentally, and they've been kind of derailed. They've been sent off in a completely new direction, but very suddenly.
Yeah.
And I suppose in the end, I don't think that's so strange. You know, I've had a lot of people in the past telling me that my characters are on the edge of society somehow, or a very eccentric or a very bizarre, you know. I've had to give talks on on bizarre characters in fiction, you know, and I actually don't think that. I sort of think they're just versions of your everyman out on the street. I mean, I think most people are like that, and most people do have a moment where their life is kind of suddenly sent off in a direction that they didn't imagine.
But
I mean, Auden has that great thing about every child is waiting for the moment that how does it go? Do you know that quote?
Yeah, I vaguely. Unfortunately, I can't. I don't have the jukebox
going. It's every child waits for the moment of trauma that will make him take his life seriously. Something like that.
Yeah.
And interesting that he says take his life seriously, as if you had a completely untroubled, as if you had a happy childhood and untroubled life, somehow it would remain superficial, which I don't entirely believe. I think it's kind of almost impossible thing to achieve.
Yeah.
I mean, but you know, no, I mean, I sort of think my characters are just sort of slightly extreme versions of the everyday. Maybe I just simply like push them a little bit towards the edge to make the point.
But this third way you were sort of describing, you know, the third way, is the end of this book. Oddly enough, it's interesting because the book of Revelation has a sort of similar end, and I don't want to give either of the two books away in the sense that it ends on this note of possible ambiguity, because as he is, you know, in this particular position, the actual, you know, terrible thought on my mind that actually, you know, pertaining to the sort of scenario that he and his wife were talking about, it's like, oh, we could have at least allowed our daughter to, you know, be, you know, thrown off of the, you know, we could have like acted as if she had died. And so with, you know, my question, I suppose, is the optimistic part of me said, okay, maybe he will finally take a stand and he will take his responsibility. But the other part of me said, no, 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 no. Since he's been haunted by the murderer, he could actually, he could become the corporeal form of the murderer, you know, here, hypothetically.
Especially having stuffed that newspaper into the bin.
Exactly.
He's now going to take over, you mean?
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's really strange you should say that, because someone said that in an interview yesterday. And that's the first time anyone, well, you're the first two people to have ever said it. It was never said in the UK at all. And actually, I hadn't imagined that, because the way I designed the book was the way I thought about the... We've talked about the intricate structure, but if you look at the very general structure, as he goes through the night, his... Because I do see this as kind of confessional, except he's confessing not to a priest, but to a murderer. You know, he spends all night really confessing to you, the reader, about what he's done. And the confessions get worse. You know, I guess he saves the worst till last. So as the memories get... As the memories he's giving you get darker and darker and more troubled, I wanted the kind of the love that he feels for his, particularly for his daughter, to grow stronger. You know, so that by the end you've almost got the two. I saw it as a pair of scissors.
Yeah.
You know, that the two blades of the scissors are wide apart, because almost at the moment where he's confessing to having murdered an old man, he is owning up to love of his daughter. You know, these two things are almost happening at the same, not quite at the same moment, but pretty much.
But not just that, though, because, oh, well, there's this goes into the whole stoned idea. There's stones throughout this book. There's the eight ball that Venetia hands him.
Yeah.
There's the stones that, you know, are mystically, you know, to protect against evil that his wife hands him. And then, when he is quite literally stoned, Billy commits this really sort of ethically questionable act against his girl, his wife, I believe.
His wife.
Which, this, I want, there, it's almost as if there's some sort of millstone that he's constantly being handed by this burden, and whether it's actually of his own making or something that other people hand to him. This is the fascinating sort of question.
Well, you see, this is the job, though, weirdly. I mean, this is like the policeman's lot in life.
Yeah.
I mean, I realized from talking to a lot of them that you know, like, you never, one policeman never asks another about how his home life is,
because
they always know what the answer is going to be. You know, it's always going to be terrible. There's never good news.
Yeah.
And because they, because of the way they work, it's like they're permanently jet-lagged policemen, at least the UK are. You know, they do 2 mornings, 2 days, and then 2 nights, and then they have 3 days off or 4 days off. But they spend the first 3 days of those 3 days off acclimatizing, reacclimatizing to normal life. And actually, they're never allowed normal life anyway, because they can't drink where they work. And they, you know, policemen are still kind of, socially, they're sort of outcasts, generally. I mean, you know, you... How many policemen have you met at a party? I mean,
society's dustmen, you know.
Yeah. So they're not only not getting paid, but they're not really allowed to have a good time either when they're not getting paid, you know, when they're out of uniform. I mean, and the things that they have to see and the things they have to deal with are not things you can close the office door on, you know. They're things that they take home with them, mm-hmm. and the wives and children kind of have to deal with as well. Yeah. So the millstone is, it's a multifaceted millstone, yeah. if there is such a thing.
Or even the cyclical nature of Billy's life, how it constantly goes in this continuous circle, and you know, the ultimate sort of way of actually pointing this out to him is give him the eight ball, which is the thing you don't want to hit, you know?
Yes, you see, I hadn't thought that. I thought about it as being a black ball, and it's a black girl who gives it to him. Mm. So that was what I was thinking about. And also, like, she knows he's a police... Well, it's this whole thing about does she or doesn't she know he's a policeman?
Yeah.
Because they had one prior meeting and she claims not to remember it. But since she's going to use him as a policeman later on in the novel to do what she wants to have done...
Oh, wow.
I wanted her to break the law in a very simple, obvious way. Like stealing the ball off the table is kind of breaking the law and testing him.
I just thought it was like it was another sort of thing. Here he is, the sort of proverbial straight arrow cue ball.
Oh.
And the thing that you don't...
You read this a completely different way.
No, I know. And what you don't want to hit as you're trying to actually get through life, get through the game, is the black ball, is the eight ball. And so I thought that she gave it to him because and it was like that stalled him further in addition to the millstones that are supposed to work.
Oh, so you could read it that way because you could read it, it could be saying not what he thinks. He thinks, you know, this means she's going to sleep with me.
Yeah.
Which actually she sort of, she does. But you could think, that ball says nothing's going to happen between us.
Yeah.
In many ways, which of course it doesn't as well, you know, because it's a very finite affair that they have.
Yeah.
And that I hadn't noticed that.
Oh.
There we go, back to Louise Bourgeois.
Yeah, I know.
But you know, there's another lovely story about that, which is Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and I think his daughter was going to school and they were actually reading one of his own, they're reading one of Dad's stories in the classroom. And it was I forget which story it was now, it was featured a cockerel in it anyway. And the teacher was asking all the children what the significance of this cockerel, she felt it was very significant as a symbol. And they all came up with different things. And of course the daughter was able to go home and ask Dad, who actually wrote the thing, you know, what was the significance of the cockerel? And he said, I don't know, it was just a cockerel as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
And you know, it's kind of a deflating answer. It's not really what people want to hear.
Yeah.
But the curious thing is that he probably, because he's so well attuned and he's such an intuitive writer himself, he probably chose, it probably is the perfect thing to have there, whatever it's doing, you know. I mean, I love that side of writing, actually, that side that's almost happening in another dimension. You know, you can, as I said earlier, you can kind of check on it and you can approve of it, but you can't even notice, you don't even notice all of it.
Yeah.
As we've just proved, you know.
Actually, while we're on this sort of subject of what is in the text and what is not, there are a good deal of, you know, truncated aspects to this text. Susie becomes Sue. And the ellipses make a more prominent appearance in these books very frequently. And I actually wanted to sort of ask you about this in terms of, we started off this conversation about, you know, you deciding not to actually name Myra Henley because it was too long, and did this likewise sort of affect these other sort of characters, and did this also kind of provoke the ellipses appearing?
Well, you'd have to give me more examples, but I mean the Susie Sue thing, I wanted I love this idea of what I'm trying to convey in a very economical way as possible is a marriage that has kind of reached a point where it might not go any further, you know. It's lost all the magic it had, and it's become predictable, and sort of, it's lost, there's nothing dynamic about it anymore. And the names, having a girl go from being called Susie to being called simple old plain Sue, sort of said that without me having to say hardly anything else. You know, the idea that the sexiness of Susie as against the kind of dull monosyllable of Sue.
Yeah.
Was an obvious thing to do somehow.
But there's also the ellipses that often like sort of make their way in as Billy is sort of trailing off in terms of thinking about something, or you're describing something. There's the dot dot dot.
Oh, right, in that sense.
Yeah, that's what I'm sort of suggesting. Yeah.
Well, but I wanted that. I this whole thing of flashing back and dealing with memory. I mean, I wanted all this kind of incompleteness around. I think this book more than any other has, I mean, it probably has more room for the reader in it than any other book I've written. And I think that's partly a function of that technique, actually, of not just ellipses, but removing sentences wherever I could. I mean, I've always done that,
yeah.
But I'm doing it more with this book than ever before. And somehow, I think I've left all these spaces and gaps for the reader to inhabit and maneuver in, you know, and I love that feeling of the book almost being more space than type.
So this constant sort of revision is really sort of a matter of, I guess, making these holes or these niches where the reader can actually inhabit and draw his or her own particular conclusions.
Yeah, and not
really
not
getting away from the literal, so to speak.
Yes, and not blurring a point that could be more crisply made. You know, I mean, I'd simply descriptions, and I just with every aspect of this, I kind of tried to remove and remove and remove.
Yeah.
And it always feels very daring when you do that.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of feel you're terrified, but you also feel really strong for doing it. And I guess there is a point where if you remove too much, it's going to fall apart completely. And of course, you have to be very aware of that precipice and not going over it.
I wanted to actually ask you about the scenario with Mary Betts, who leaves the voicemail. The interesting thing is that in addition to all the other problems that Billy has, there's this whole pigeons coming home to roost sort of feel to the book.
Yeah.
That, I mean, and the other thing
the
is...
The wrong pigeons.
And because Billy is incapable of any kind of real sort of direct action, it's almost as if he totally inhabits the past, but yet it comes in so many sort of possible ways. Is it Raymond? Is it the pigeons coming home to roost? Is it his sort of familial responsibilities? Is it the fact that his marriage just doesn't seem to have the life that it does anymore?
Mm.
And I guess, did you want to just basically just throw as many possible sort of, I guess, MacGuffins, existential MacGuffins, so to speak, at Billy just to really...
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think I've always done that. In fact, my wife always says, why do you create these lovely characters and then do such awful things to them? This was the Mary Betts thing. I mean, that particular... We say chickens coming home to... Did you say pigeons?
Anyway.
That particular pigeon...
It may be very well be a chicken.
I think it's chickens coming home to roost. Anyway, maybe I just had chicken, and that's what, I know I didn't have pigeon.
Maybe it's the pigeons I saw on the way here. I don't know, but...
No, I mean, there had to be... What I really knew I had to have was some kind of... some slender connection between Billy Tyler and Myra Hindley, the murderer. You know, there had to be some kind of connection, and this meeting of the childhood friend in the kind of nowhere place, you know, in this travelodge, which is like, as Billy says, this would be a terrible place to die. These are kind of hotels that are always on the junctions of motorways in the UK. They're never in towns. Well, very rarely in towns. They're always in completely nowhere places, you know, and they're just generally populated by salesmen, traveling
yeah.
salesmen. And
I don't know if that was your car guys. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You want to call?
Is he there? Oh, damn. Have you had enough time?